The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The English language is awash in portmanteaus, words or sounds that merge together to create something new. Spoon and fork combine to make spork. Breakfast and lunch join to create brunch. And here's one you may not know. Velcro, the combination of two French words, velour and crochet, which mean velvet, and hook. Celebrity couples are often referred to with the help of a catchy portmanteau, which Stephen Colbert once referred to as one of the secrets to long-lasting love.
Law number one, find someone whose name can be merged with yours to form a marketable nickname. Just like Brangelina, Benifer II, or Philium H. Muffman.
It turns out that Colbert's first law of love is not bulletproof. Rest in peace, Benifer II. Still, merging words, sounds, or celebrity names is easy. Other types of mergers, not so much. Today's show is all about what happens when two things become one. From traffic lanes to company buyouts to organ transplants, we'll discover that merging is anything but simple. Let's kick off the show with the type of merger that many listeners will be familiar with, the relationship. Communication is the bedrock of a healthy relationship, but there's one type of conversation that couples are notorious for avoiding: anything having to do with money. Financial discussions are the leading cause of stress in relationships, with many couples choosing to passive-aggressively seethe or avoid the topic altogether. We spoke to Liz Weston. She's a nationally syndicated finance columnist to get some advice on when couples should buckle down and have the money talk.
I think as soon as you are talking about moving in together, that's kind of the point at which you really do need to talk about whether you're going to merge your finances, what your financial condition is. And this is a particularly contentious topic when it comes to student loan debt, because there's a few people out there that have a ton of it. And that can really affect the relationship, or any kind of debt for that matter. You know, if you have debts you haven't paid, if you're getting collection calls, that kind of thing, you might not want to talk to your partner about that because it doesn't really reflect well on you. You might think that they, you know, will reject you for that. It might not be something you want to bring up on the first date, but it's definitely something you need to talk about before you take the step of moving in together.
Well, there is a lot of judgment when it comes to money and how people manage their finances. So when it comes to combining accounts or deciding to merge finances, what are some of the things that couples should consider?
Well, one thing to consider is that what works for you might not work for someone else, and vice versa. So I wouldn't let anyone dictate how you handle your own finances. Understand that people come from different points of view. They have different experiences with money. And if you're one of those people like me who's good with money, don't just assume your way is right. You know, that's one of the big problems, is that we come into the scene going, hey, I'm going to tell you what to do. That's not the way to have, you know, a good nurturing relationship. You need to understand where the other person is coming from. You need to compromise. You need to figure out something that works for the two of you. Might not work for your parents, might not work for your friends, but if it works for you, then that's good.
Well, most of our parents, if they stayed together, did have their accounts completely merged. Are more couples choosing to keep their finances separate now that people earn differently? And women, of course, are earning a lot more than they did traditionally.
Well, it seems that if you've been through a divorce, you are much more likely to consider separate accounts. And if you have kids from a previous marriage, again, separate accounts might be the way to handle those kind of expenses without having a lot of argument. With my husband and I, we have joint accounts for paying most of the bills, but we each have a slush fund, no questions asked money. And it really, really helps, because he's an artist. I don't want to know how many Tombow pencils he's bought, you know, and he doesn't necessarily need to know how many pedicures I have or what, you know, whatever I'm doing to keep myself lovely for him. So it's really nice to have that. And also, because of things like charge alerts that we have on all our credit cards, I know instantly if he's been to Coach to buy me a bag or if he's been out, you know, Christmas shopping. I know right where he's been. So having some separate money keeps that, you know, mystery in it so you can buy each other gifts once in a while.
Well, mystery is one thing, but another is trust. I can imagine, you know, a couple planning to get married, talking about finances. Why wouldn't you want to combine finances with me? Why can't we share all of our accounts?
Yeah, and there can be a lot of reasons why it's legitimate not to. So you need to talk about those things. I mean, prenuptials seem to be only a thing that are discussed in very wealthy families and in Hollywood. But the discussion you need to have that goes into a prenuptial is a discussion every couple should have, which is what are our assets separately and together? What are our debts separately and together? What are our goals? What are we, you know, when do we hope to retire? Do we want to have kids? How many kids? You know, are we going to send them to college? How much are we going to save for that? These are really difficult discussions. You're not going to just have one of these. You're going to have them going along where you need to adjust and figure out. And, you know, if you have a setback financially, how are you going to handle that? Again, these are all very personal things, and people are going to handle these discussions differently, and they're going to handle the setup differently. The most important thing is you need to talk about it. I used to think that, you know, the occasional little white lie, you know, you buy something, you don't tell your partner about it, whatever it is, I thought that was okay. But really, that's a form of infidelity. You're not being honest. You're hiding something. You're not talking about something. And, you know, the more secrets you have from your partner, the less intimacy there is. So you need to figure out, if you're not telling your partner something, why? And if you are deliberately keeping a secret, maybe you want to expose that and talk about it. If there's one partner who's, say, you know, controlling and doesn't want you spending money, well, that needs to be talked about. You know, you're not parent and child. You are partners. You're equals. So you need to work out a spending pattern where you don't have to hide things or you don't have to be overbearing and telling your partner what to do. And this really needs to be a kind of give and take. So anytime there's a secret, that's worth exploring. That's worth talking about.
I don't know, Liz. Sounds like the work of a couples counselor more than a financial planner.
You know, sometimes it is. And there are some financial planners who have experience in coaching people through this. There are also some therapists who have experience, particularly with money issues. In fact, I would think most therapists would have some experience with guiding couples through these issues because they can be really, really difficult. Now, that's not to say you have to involve a third party, but if you come to an impasse where you really can't see each other's point of view, you can't work out a compromise, and you want the relationship to continue, maybe it's worth hiring a third person to come in and give you some feedback.
Well, Liz Weston, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for asking me, Virginia.
Liz Weston, she's an award-winning, nationally syndicated personal finance columnist and author of the book Your Credit Score, which is now in its fourth edition. So, merging finances can be a difficult conversation for couples, and while many choose to combine their assets, a growing number of couples decide to keep them separate. Word of Mouth producer Logan Shannon and her husband, Derek Janiak, had the dreaded money talk before they got married and opted not to merge their bank accounts. And while Logan will tell you that the financial conversation they had was definitely an uncomfortable one, it was nothing compared to the talk they had when they decided to share an organ.
When Derek and I first met back in 2006, he told me that someday he would need an organ transplant. He had a rare and chronic disease that was slowly destroying his liver, and without a transplant, he would die. When his liver finally began to fail in 2013, I underwent testing to see if I could be his donor. Livers are made up of multiple lobes that can be surgically separated. So one part, in my case 40%, stayed with me, growing to nearly its original size in 3 short months. The larger part was transplanted into Derek with the idea that it would grow to the optimal size for his body's needs. That didn't happen, and Derek wound up needing another transplant 28 days later from an organ donor.
7.9. How far out are you now?
A year.
You're 14 months.
14
May
months.
Was the second transplant.
May 13th, right?
Yep.
At a recent checkup at Lehigh Hospital with one of Derek's transplant surgeons,
James John Pompaselli.
So you had questions?
Yeah.
I decided to ask Dr. Pompaselli a few questions to find out what happens when an organ taken from one body is merged into the body of another.
The natural instinct of the body is to reject any foreign object or tissue, and that's why transplant patients need immunosuppression to prevent that from happening.
So that's how you control it. You give them drugs?
Yes. Or if you have an identical twin, you wouldn't need the drugs. But for most patients, obviously, we need drugs to dampen the immune system so they don't reject the organ.
So is it the same with all organs, or are some organs and tissues more easily accepted by the body?
Yes. Liver is actually one that's one of the easier ones to accept. Liver transplant's technically challenging, but immunologically pretty easy. Kidney transplant, on the other hand, is technically a relatively easy operation, but immunologically much tougher. Skin transplants are actually fairly difficult immunologically. So bowel transplants, another one, because bowel has a lot of lymphatic tissue within it. So those are types of organs that are easier to reject than, say, a liver is.
I know we talked about identical twins, but there are any instances where it's not an identical twin situation, would they ever accept the organ?
Yeah, generally, right off the bat, no. But there have been cases of people who've been transplanted and then years later, maybe for whatever reason, they stopped their immunosuppression medication. And about 10% of those patients end up not rejecting the organ. 90% will. And that's where the whole concept of chimerism has come in, based on these kind of natural experiments that have occurred in transplant patients.
That word, chimerism, you may have heard it before. A chimera was, according to Greek mythology, a terrifying creature. Homer described one in the Iliad this way: a thing of immortal make, not human, lion-fronted and snake-behind, a goat in the middle, and snorting out the breath of the terrible flame of bright fire. These days, a chimera or chimerism describes anything composed of separate parts, typically mythical and definitely outrageous. When it comes to organ and tissue transplants, chimerism gets a little more complicated.
So can you test a patient and see if they were a chimera, if they were actually accepting the organ?
Yeah, so developing chimerism is not the same as developing tolerance. So tolerance means that your body has accepted the organ and won't reject it. Chimerism is basically just demonstrating that the recipient has some of the donor white cells in their blood. So having the state of chimerism is not the same as developing tolerance.
Part of my liver was inside my husband Derek's abdomen for about 28 days. So does he still have my DNA in his body?
He might. Basically what happens is when you have a transplant, there, even though we flush the organs of any blood, there are always some white cells, what we call passenger leukocytes, that come across. And then invariably those get kind of rinsed into the recipient. Whether or not they stay and populate and grow and thrive, we would have to test and basically see if he has any white cells that are XX chromosome, which would suggest female, versus, you know, XY. So it's possible that there are some of your cells circulating, but there may not be.
Okay, so then his situation is a little unique because I donated part of my organ, but that organ failed. And then you took an organ from another donor and transplanted it into him.
Was that a male or a female? I can't remember.
That was a male.
It was a male. So we could test him, and if he has any female cells, that would be from you.
Okay, but so technically, like if you took a DNA sample from him right now, would you see three sets of DNA?
Well, if you look specifically at the white cells, it's possible, yes. You know, if you just took a, you know, hair sample from him, it wouldn't show. It would have to be of the white cells circulating in his blood.
If you think about your job and what you do, you're taking organs from donors and you're transplanting them into recipients. Is it like you're merging two people together?
We don't really look at it that way, although it is an interesting concept. Although we all have heard anecdotal stories of people, you know, saying, yeah, I love mustard now and I hated mustard before a transplant. And then the donor family says, well, oh, you know, my son loved mustard, you know, that kind of thing. You do hear those kinds of stories of, which makes you wonder if something is coming across. But we don't really think about it as a merging per se, but it is.
I had a thought, dear, however scary, about that night, the bugs and the dirt.
Word of Mouth producer Logan Shannon there, speaking with Dr. John Pompaselli, Surgical Director of Transplantation at Lahey Hospital and Medical Center. We are thrilled to report that Logan and her husband Derek are doing very well. They shared their transplant story with NHPR health reporter Todd Bookman last summer. You'll find a link to hear that story at wordofmouthradio.org.
Honey, just put your sweet lips on my lips. We should just kiss like real people do.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today we're talking about how complicated it can be when things merge. And now to storms. In late October of 1991, meteorologists began tracking a troubling storm off the northeastern coast of Canada. Meanwhile, to the south, a weakened hurricane was making its way up the eastern seaboard. Here's Stu Ostero from the Weather Channel's Forecast Center back in 1991.
You're right there, that's Hurricane Grace. However, you then see this energy swing down around, absorb Grace into its circulation. And I think what Grace did was inject...
Nor'easters are not unusual in New England during the fall, but this one was different. The cold nor'easter and the warm weather hurricane did not just combine into a larger storm. Together, they created a whole new Category 1 hurricane. To avoid confusion, meteorologists called it the no-name storm. It wasn't until later that author Sebastian Younger rebranded the confluence as the perfect storm. He got the name from Bob Case, a National Weather Service and NOAA meteorologist working out of the Boston office at the time.
I'm describing the various aspects, how they had to mesh in time and space for this to occur. I said it was almost like a perfect situation, a perfect storm in that respect. And he told me, he said, as soon as I used the word perfect, he said he remembers jotting it down, The Perfect Storm, that's the name of my book.
Had either storm system changed course slightly, they would have passed by each other. The weakening tropical storm would have eventually dissipated at sea, and the nor'easter up in Canada might have whipped up winds along the shore for a day or two and then moved out to the Atlantic. But back in 1991, everything that could have gone wrong did. And the result of that merging was catastrophic.
They said there was a wave height observed on a buoy off the coast of Nova Scotia of 100.7 feet. That's phenomenal. I've never heard of a wave that high, but that storm was one of a kind, truly.
That's Jason Salmonow, the weather editor for The Washington Post. We spoke to him about the potential volatility of a pair of powerful weather systems becoming one.
When two storms merge, in a lot of cases, the effect will be to consolidate them into one larger and more intense storm.
Largely due to Younger's book and the Hollywood film based on it, The Perfect Storm of 1991 will be remembered as a devastating weather event. But most of its fury was centered out at sea, where the Andrea Gale, a commercial fishing boat carrying six men from Gloucester, Massachusetts, went down. Much more substantial damage was done when another pair of storms merged in October of 2012. The result was Hurricane Sandy. Meteorologist Chad Myers from CNN remembers how difficult it was to predict when that Frankenstorm would make landfall.
There's a cold air mass back here. There's a low here and another low here, and they're going to combine. What is going to happen when those two combine? We honestly simply don't know. There's not been any history for this in the computer program.
Whenever you have the greatest temperature contrast, that is when you have the most energy for storms to develop. And when you can get a storm with more of a warm weather origin combining with a storm which has more of a cold weather origin, that is when you have a very explosive situation on your hands.
So that's two giant storms entered to devastating effect into the weather history books in just about two decades. So are superstorms, or so-called Frankenstorms, becoming more common?
Whether we're seeing an increase in the intensity of storms that are merging together, you know, those are in a class of their own, and they're relatively rare and infrequent. So We don't have a sample size which is big enough to know for sure whether storms like the Perfect Storm and Superstorm Sandy are becoming more intense or more frequent. They just don't happen enough for us to know.
As that hot air rises, cool air is sucked in to replace it. That effect is drawing these sharknadoes to the very heart of the city. Now, if these two EF2 tornadoes merge, their power could actually multiply. We could be talking about an EF5 sharknado on the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
And our thanks to Jason Salmonow, weather editor for The Washington Post, for speaking to us about what happens when storms collide. Much like the hurricane season and weather patterns, rises and falls in the business world can be volatile and hard to predict. Companies form, companies fail, and mergers seem to come in waves. Take the merger mania that happened back in late February of 2013. Here's Jon Stewart commenting on it from The Daily Show.
The merger mania. Who are the lucky couples? Details, details.
Office Depot and Office Max are merging.
American Airlines and U.S. Airways.
Anheuser-Busch and Grupo Modelo.
Warren Buffett is buying what? He's buying Heinz. Jiffy Pop and Jiffy Lube.
These days, the merger wave is riding on healthcare. Just 3 weeks after health insurance company Aetna offered to buy Humana, another giant in the health insurance industry, Anthem, announced it had agreed to buy Cigna for $48.3 billion. Now, whether the government regulators will allow these mergers to come to fruition remains to be seen. In the meantime, we decided to talk to our tech expert, Rob Fleischman, about what it's like to be on the front lines of a merger. Well, Rob, in the past, we've always introduced you as Rob Fleischman, the Chief Technology Officer of Zerocoal, but that recently changed. What's the new title?
That's right. I am now a principal engineer at Akamai, based in Cambridge, Mass, and a large infrastructure company, over 5,000 employees. And it was a wonderful outcome for Zerocoal, for both its shareholders and its employees.
Okay, so they bought your company. Was your company actively seeking buyers, or did they come to you?
Well, that's a great question. So what happened was last year, we decided that we really wanted to expand into other countries to get to customers that we really had never approached before. Our products were doing really well, and we were very successful. So we looked at a couple options. One option would be to grow rapidly. And to do that, our revenue wasn't high enough to hire a lot of people. So we were going to have to raise money. And as you're probably aware, if you raise money, you need to give out shares of the company to do that. So we looked at doing that. And our CEO decided, along with the board, that going that way would cause us to give up so much of the company that would it would be hard to earn that back. So rather than go that route, raise money and dilute all of our ownership, we started to head down the merger acquisition route. And we talked to a number of customers, and there were some that were interested. We talked to some of our competition, actually. That was a little difficult to do, but we spoke to people in our space. And then we talked to partners and people in adjacent spaces. And we had about 10 companies interested. We had a handful give us actual physical offers on paper. They're called letters of intent. And then we negotiated with a couple and decided to go with Akamai.
All right,
and
so
it was a really good outcome for us.
Okay, so my impression of this in the technology space anyway is that, you know, small company, a bunch of guys in a garage basically putting together software, some kind of product. It's seen to be as ingenious. Some big company comes and buys it for fat stacks of cash. And then the principals end up, you know, sitting on a beach sipping Mai Tais. So you're here. You're not sitting on a beach sipping a Mai Tai.
Well, that sounds like the dot-com crazy days when or, you know, the app writing days where you think, oh, you know, I'm going to get a bunch of eyeballs, an IPO, and we're all going to buy a place in Malibu and sit around smoking cigars. Or, oh, my app is going to go viral on the Apple Store, and I'm going to get hordes of cash. And the reality is it doesn't really work that way. Acquirers, people that purchase companies and assets, are not silly. They're smart. And you know, let's take a great analogy that works for you. Let's say Rob Fleischman wanted to buy word of mouth. Let's say I wanted to buy the whole show.
How much?
I don't know. Let's, you know, maybe we'll talk about that after the show. But it's pretty unlikely that I'd let Virginia Prescott, who is an asset, an important part of the show, I certainly wouldn't let you go on vacation for the next 10 years because you're really part of what I'm purchasing.
Mm-hmm. You know? So they're not just acquiring the assets of the company. They are acquiring you on some level.
Absolutely. So there are really, you know, if you think about this, many, many types of ways to do mergers and acquisitions. But I kind of break it down into two types. There are asset purchases, where a company comes in and says, you know what, I don't want to buy word of mouth. I want to buy parts of it. I want to buy all the old shows, you know, because I want to do, you know, let's say I want to buy the Gilligan's Island tapes so I can play them on my radio station or TV station.
Right.
Okay. So that's an asset. I don't want to buy the producers. I don't want to buy any hardware. I want to buy a particular piece of asset of the company. Or I want to buy your customer list. Or maybe I want to buy certain employees or things like that. So that's an asset purchase. And then there's an acquisition where you take the whole thing. You want to buy everything. But even in that situation where you're purchasing the whole company, you have a certain reason for doing that. So, you know, Akamai, of course, wanted our people, our technology, and our customers. They really wanted everything. But I've been a part of mergers and acquisitions that haven't been like that. For example, I've had companies in the past where I've been the acquirer. Where I looked at the company, and let's take a, you know, a sad scenario. Your company went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. You know, so you went bankrupt, and there you are in Chapter 11. And a company like mine comes along and says, hey, you know what? There's some stuff here that's valuable, like maybe this the customer base. Or maybe there's some technology here, maybe a patent that I'd like to buy. So I come along, and I buy assets of the company. And that's mergers and acquisitions, too. That's usually a sad situation. I've sadly been on both sides of that, where my company went under and we sort of sold whatever was left to whoever wanted it. And I've also been on the other side where I've sort of picked through the ashes of a bankrupt company and bought certain things.
But are there people who do sell their companies and they do buy the place in Malibu and sip Mai Tais?
That does happen. And the scenario where that happens is when the acquirer is not interested in the particulars of what that person does. So let's take an example. Let's say that I'm a salesperson at a technology company, and I'm, let's say, selling to New England here in, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, et cetera. And we get acquired by a large company that already has a big sales force, and they already have a lot of people in New England selling. Well, that might be a scenario where they say, hey, Rob, you know what? It's wonderful you're here, but, you know, we don't really have a spot for you in our sales organization. So here's a package, you know, go look for a new job somewhere else. And hopefully in that scenario, I'm not just an employee. Hopefully I'm also a shareholder and I have a bunch of stock that gets exchanged for either other stock or cash. And in that situation, I kind of do ride off into the sunset. But usually that doesn't happen. Usually people are acquired and the acquiring company brings over most, if not all, the employees.
But how about when these, you know, giant companies merge like Kraft and Heinz did in earlier in the spring? What happens then, you know, to all of the Kraft employees or all the Heinz employees? Like, who's in charge and who gets to say who stays and who goes?
Well, those situations are, of course, very, very complex and generally lead to layoffs. I mean, we'd all like to think it's a one big happy family, but there's a tremendous amount of overlap. I mean, just think about just infrastructure things like, well, how many tax departments do we need? Mm-hmm. How many accounting departments do we need? So usually what happens in those scenarios is, you know, initially everyone's still working, doing what they're doing. The merger closes, all the financials are done, the companies get together and then decide who's going to lead what departments and what departments are overlapping and what departments come together. And sadly, what happens is when there is an overlap, the department heads get together and decide what employees they're going to keep and what employees they're not going to keep. And that's where layoffs and, you know, retirement packages and those sorts of things, severance packages are put together. Usually it's between 6 months to 2 years after the merger completes. And I strongly suspect, you know, you mentioned the Heinz Kraft merger. I strongly suspect that'll happen. I mean, there's going to be quite a bit of overlap in that merger. I mean, they're both food companies. You can imagine they have lots and lots of things that they do together. Manufacturing plants, sales.
Research,
absolutely. Is the resulting company going to be stronger? Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. But it's an opportunity for them to remove overlap and cut waste. Kind of an excuse for that, too.
Well, you bring up a question for me. Is there always a winner and a loser in a merger? Is there any such thing as a mutually beneficial merger?
Oh, absolutely. And I've actually been a part of one of those. One of my earliest mergers was I was with a company called Highwind Software. and we merged with a company called ISP News, and the resulting company was called Be Candid. So how did that happen? Well, what happened was my company had a lot of technology assets. We had products and patents and customers. And this other company, ISP News, had all the stuff we didn't have. They had marketing and sales and management and finances, and their technology was pretty weak. So we looked at each other and we said, I said, wow, you guys have this sales staff and this whole infrastructure here set up to grow. And I have all this technology, but none of that stuff. So we looked at each other and we did a terrific merger of equals. And it was a 1+1=3 type scenario. And their salespeople, everyone kept their jobs. Everyone even kept their positions. But we came together as equals. And I've seen that happen. It doesn't happen as much as, mergers where there's clearly one company that survives and the other merges into it. But mergers of equals do happen and happen all the time.
Rob Fleischman, recently signed, sealed, and delivered to Akamai. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure to be here, Virginia.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The song is a beautiful example of the artistry of merging sound and ideas. A songwriter puts together a series of notes, then they or a lyricist adds words. A singer breathes emotion and life into the product, and musicians combine their talents to create a complete and cohesive piece of music. Mashup artists do it a little differently. They take two or more hooks or completed songs and merge them together to make something entirely different, yet strangely evocative of the original. Andrew Davis brings us a brief evolution of the musical mashup.
DJ Hood, DJ Adrian, and the Mysterious D, and a guy who calls himself Girl Talk, are all mashup artists. Here's a nice definition of a mashup.
A mashup, in the most general sense of the word, is a piece of media that's derived from two or more source materials, usually consisting of like nearly equal parts of both, so that it comes together to create one cohesive derivative work. For a lot of people, the first thing that comes to mind is like a music video mashup.
That's Chris Menning, a researcher, writer, and community manager at knowyourmeme.com. Every day, Chris watches internet memes like mashups take hold and spread across the globe, and for a long time, he's charted the evolution of music mashups. In the summer of 2009, one mashup caught Chris's ear.
The first one that comes to mind for me is the Never Gonna Give Your Teen Spirit Up mashup that takes Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up and takes the vocal track from that and overlays it on top of Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. Oh, they work really good together. You'd be surprised.
Chris says mashups have been around a long time.
Prior to YouTube and a lot of the video mixing, there were all kinds of audio mashups. A lot of it came right out of just the whole hip-hop remix culture. But at the same time, there was also this bastard pop movement happening. The first band that comes to mind for me was the band Pop Will Eat Itself. And today there are still other mashup artists like Girl Talk that will take sometimes dozens of different songs and create something completely new out of all of it.
The band Pop Will Eat Itself started mashing up music in the 1980s, but according to Chris, the internet has changed the game and accelerated the art form's adoption.
The internet has definitely helped the whole mashup art form to proliferate and reach a widespread audience. In the past, people had to hand each other their own little bootleg tapes and stuff. And today, somebody can just create a mashup in their bedroom on a weekend and share it with all their friends, put it on YouTube, and if they promote it the right way, spread it to potentially millions of people.
Along with the millions of people consuming new mashup material, Chris has seen the term co-opted by web developers who are building their own versions of music mashups.
There are data mashups all the time. There are lots of different companies that are into having an open API so that you can use the data from their program and mash it up with data from other programs. An example of that would be how YouTube has recently added location-based search that is effectively a mashup of YouTube and Google Maps. But then there are also third parties, like the Dippity Timeline web app has been mashed up with YouTube search to create TimeTube so that you can search YouTube but have your results displayed in an easy-to-navigate timeline. It's still a mashup, regardless of whether or not the source material was something that's had widespread public exposure or if it's user-generated content. I think they're both still mashups in the same sense, but I really think this concept of mashing up all of this crowdsourced content is, you know, something kind of unique and interesting. You know, on YouTube, a lot of it takes the form of music video mashups, where it's not just the song, but they'll take elements from both videos. But then you can take the trend of YouTube poop, where people actually take all sorts of videos from YouTube that don't even have to be related in any kind of context, and they'll like word splice them to make the characters sound like they're saying different phrases.
Today on the internet, people are mashing up everything from novels to movie trailers to create new iterations of creative content, like this one that Brad Schwarzenbach showed me at through-u.com.
The through-u experience it's quite remarkable. What Cootie Man has done is he's gone out and found YouTube videos that people have posted of themselves playing musical instruments, making ambient noise, just all sorts of audio. And he has literally cut these videos together into his own sort of music video mashups using completely found video.
Okay, so let's take a few seconds to listen to what Cootie Man has created.
I think the world thinks that I have no sense because I'm working as a tent, making a few cents, working a job with my co-workers.
In that short little clip, you hear an upright bass, a piano, a guy rapping, bongos, a drummer, a few keyboards, and even a jazz quartet. Now keep in mind, these are all video clips that on their own sound like this. So here's just the drums. Okay, now the MC, the guy rapping you heard, sounds like this on his own clip on YouTube.
I think the world thinks that I have no sense because I'm working as a tent, making a few cents, working a job with my co-workers, roaches and rats. And they the good ones, the others addicted to crack.
Now one more time together.
I think the world thinks that I have no sense because I'm working as a tent, making a few cents, working a job with my co-workers, roaches and rats. And they the good ones, the others addicted to crack.
Brad, who's a new media strategist at an agency in Boston called Tipping Point Labs, sees this as a really innovative approach to developing new content.
The content Cootie Man uses individually and independently doesn't add a lot of value. It tends to be people talking into their webcams or playing their piano, whether it's their own music or someone else's. So in and of themselves, it's not all that valuable, but what he does is he finds all this stuff and he cuts it together and he extends the value and turns it into something, you know, beautiful, really. It's like, you know, a street artist taking found art and cutting it together to make something wondrous.
But is this art? Are these mashup artists?
Well, it certainly takes a lot of time to edit this kind of project together, but it's definitely art because he's taking something that exists. It's content that may or may not be adding value and probably has a very small audience. You know, someone probably put a little video of themselves. I know there's one of a woman holding her own child on her knee, and she's just singing into a webcam, and that might be for the grandmother or something, but he's taken this and turned it into something amazing. She's the centerpiece of one of his songs. And how can you not say that it's art? It's come from this man's mind by taking pieces that he's experienced in life.
So as Chris says,
in mashups sort of come in all shapes and sizes. It's kind of a nebulous thing.
In Boston, Massachusetts, I'm Andrew Davis.
I wasn't looking for this, but now you're in my way. But you didn't have to cut me off. Make out like it never happened. We were nothing, and I don't even.
So far, we've talked about merging companies, storms, and songs. And finally, we turn to the road, where we encounter some form of merging just about every day.
Motorists here are bound together by certain practical rules and courtesies necessary for mutual protection. And any individual who does not or will not recognize this is a menace to everyone.
That clip was from a Disney educational driving film from the mid-60s called Freeway Phobia, or The Art of Driving the Superhighway. Breaking the laws of the road is something that most drivers do occasionally, but would agree is wrong. But merging is one aspect of driving that divides motorists into two distinct camps. To merge early or not to merge early? That is the question. We decided to consult someone who wrote a book on traffic to find out why the art of the merge is so heavy with meaning, judgment, and guilt. Tom Vanderbilt writes about design, technology, science, and culture, and his most recent book is called Traffic: Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Tom, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Okay, you're coming to a left lane and you see a big arrow that it's closing. As soon as you see the blinking arrow, you move right. That makes you an early merger. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay, so what's a late merger?
Well, the late merger is those people who, you know, when there's one lane of traffic that's going to be closing, and those are the people that go all the way to that point where it literally is vanishing, and then they merge over at the last minute. And this whole idea prompted me actually to write my book Traffic, because I was one of those people that as soon as I saw that sign, I always got over as soon as I could. But one day I was coming to the same spot in some highway construction, and I found myself frustrated by all those late mergers going ahead of me and saving a few minutes. So one day I became a late merger, and I felt, you know, so weird about it that I ended up kind of writing this whole book to explore why I had felt the way I did and why I behaved the way I did.
Well, I'm admitting to being a late merger, and I always feel slightly guilty when I'm doing it and somewhat like I'm pretending that I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah, I mean, it really speaks to, I think it speaks to people's sense of, you know, sort of social justice, not to sound too grandiose, but, you know, that they take from the regular world. Like, I mean, they think of it as someone, you know, sort of cutting in front of you. And part of the problem is the information given is often very vague. It will say something like, you know, merge right 1 mile. So you have, you know, this theoretical point, you know, do I do it now? Do I wait all the way to that closure? Do I do it somewhere in between? And I think what merging really is a form of, you know, sort of coordination problem. We haven't worked out ahead of time what each person is going to do or how we're going to do it. So we're all bringing our own strategies and beliefs to this. And it's not just at those construction work zones. I mean, even just a simple highway on-ramp merge is a problem for people because, you know, they're going at different speeds. People are sort of vague. Do I give the right-of-way to the person who's already on the highway? Am I supposed to let the person coming from the ramp in? And, you know, we haven't often worked those out ahead of time, and there's kind of a different context. And it could make us tense because we're driving at high speeds.
So when it comes to moving traffic along, which is better, an early merger or a late merger?
Some people took the late merging message a little too much to heart and, you know, started advocating it for things like jumping ahead of a queue of traffic and trying to get off at an exit, for example, when there's still an ongoing traveling. That's not what I was talking about. It was this very specific situation where you had the two lanes going down to one, and I had come across some research on different systems they had done called, for example, the late dynamic merge, which they found that in one of these construction work zone situations, when there was heavy traffic, if everyone waited, occupied both lanes, waited till they got to the point where it was going to close, then did a one-on-one zipper merge, as it's called, they actually were able to move more traffic through the bottleneck than if, you know, they let people do it anywhere along the line.
Mm-hmm. But so, that, you know, that's sort of predicated on the idea that everybody's on board and understands, okay, you go, then I go, then you go, then I go.
Exactly, and you needed this coordination that I was mentioning, and so you have to have signage that really spells this out. And to complicate things, you know, it really works best when it's full congestion, when there aren't, for example, a lot of trucks. So the engineers would know when to activate the sign that would say, you know, go all the way to the merge point, otherwise, you know, do things differently. You know, so again, you really need to spell out for people exactly how to behave, and even then, I'm sad to report, people fall back on other sorts of information. I mean, they tried this late merge situation in the state of Minnesota, and they found it wasn't working as well as they'd hoped because people were sticking to their old kind of, let's be frank, you know, sort of Minnesota polite, Minnesota nice, they call it, notions of what the right thing to do was. And to them, it felt rude to not sort of get over as soon as they can. So the argument was they were sort of making an early one-lane artificial traffic jam sooner than they needed to, and that sort of messed things up. So, you know, the lesson here is, you know, you need to spell it out as clearly as possible, and then maybe over time the habit will develop. But people can still bring their own, you know, kind of internal vision of what the right thing to do is, and that can screw up kind of the coordination problem.
And it could, I guess it could be good for traffic, but not so good for goodwill.
Exactly. And you know, this is, the debates over this are huge. And the very first time I did it, I really felt guilty myself. I mean, more than the actual act, I sort of felt a stronger emotion. It wasn't really that big of a deal in the scheme of things, but I really felt like I had done something very wrong, and I had to kind of, you know, seek consolation in friends and ask, have you ever done anything like that? You know, I skipped a few cars. It wasn't, you know, sort of like stealing something or except other people's time, perhaps.
How about in the era of self-driving cars, which we are told is imminent, what will they choose for this kind of situation?
Well, theoretically, this is a great thing where, you know, you really could work out these coordination problems ahead of time with the right software, and maybe you'd need some software upgrades. You know, as long as every car had kind of the same algorithm powering it, where it would have a rule that would sort of know what to do in the situation and would take advantage of the exact space and wouldn't get angry if it saw another vehicle nudging its way ahead on the side. It would just sort of treat that as another vehicle. I mean, you can also imagine that different companies might be on the market which would have different algorithms, and maybe those would be incompatible. So that, again, that coordination problem, this really could continue into that self-driving era. But, I mean, the one thing that they would take away would be the kind of human element of justice and wanting revenge, and I'm going to teach that person a lesson for cutting in front of me. I mean, that by itself, I think, would help matters a bit.
So let me guess, the Prius will be the early merger, and the Lexus will be the late merger.
Yeah, or people always say BMW.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say that, but I thought I'd
be the poster child of late merging right there.
So given what you just said, is getting people to merge in a way that benefits everyone, if we're assuming this zipper merge works, is this a urban planning issue and traffic pattern issue or a personality issue?
I mean, a little bit of both. I mean, you can have, you know, sort of better planning about this, you know, better systems set up, give people better information. So if they have the information, then and they're being encouraged to do a certain behavior, it takes away the idea that the other people are cheating. It sort of lays out what you're supposed to do. Because, again, in the absence of that information, people are confused and they rely on their own notions of what the right behavior is. So that's where it becomes the personal. So I think if you can, you know, take away the potential for that anger, it could, you know, make things more smoothly. But again, just physically, it's sort of a hard activity. And whenever you see traffic on the highway, you know, merging, you know, lanes coming from another highway or an oncoming stream of traffic down an on-ramp, for example, this is often where traffic, kind of everyday congestion, is coming from. It's a hard thing to physically do, to merge two vehicles into one lane at, you know, say 65 miles an hour. People are, you know, having to judge the acceptable gaps and kind of look around and look in their blind spots, and they get nervous and they brake too hard. And, you know, it's kind of a complicated bit of daily driving that I think probably ranks pretty high on people's, you know, most stressful activities.
Tom Vanderbilt writes about design, technology, science, and culture, and his most recent book is called Traffic: Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. You'll find a link to read an excerpt from the book that's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more.
Well, now it's time for us to hit the road. Thanks so much for merging with us today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also search for it in iTunes at Word of Mouth NHPR. And if you enjoy the podcast, please do pass it around and tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.